Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, by David Satter. Narrated by Paul Bryan. For nothing is hidden except to be known, and nothing is secret except to be revealed. Mark chapter 4, verse 22. Preface. In Darkness at Dawn, I have tried to describe the rise of a business criminal elite and its takeover of the machinery of the Russian state, leading to the impoverishment and demoralization of the great majority of the population. The book consists of narrative histories and personal stories. The histories show how criminal oligarchic power achieved its present dominance in Russia, while the stories of ordinary Russians provide a social context for the activities of this elite. I have chosen to describe Russia with the help of stories because Russians experienced a spiritual crisis in the reform period as a result of being confronted with a new way of life for which their previous experience had not prepared them. To understand this spiritual crisis, facts alone are not sufficient. It is necessary to grasp the psychology of Russia, and this can be conveyed only through the stories of individual lives. It is also not irrelevant that telling the stories of ordinary Russians is a way to help them. As the Danish novelist Isak Dinesen put it, all sorrows can be borne if you put them into a story or tell a story about them. Any call to personal discipline irritates Russians. Spiritual work on the formation of his personality does not present itself to the Russian as either necessary or interesting. Nikolai Berdyaev, Sudba Russi, Russia's Fate. Introduction. In 1991, Russia experienced a new dawn of freedom. The Communist Party was dissolved, and Russia appeared ready to build a democratic future. The literary critic Yuri Karyakin spoke for many when he said, "For the first time in this century, God has smiled on Russia." Few at that time could have foreseen the outlines of what exists today. In the years that followed, many former communist countries experienced a rebirth of freedom, but Russia came to be dominated by poverty, intimidation, and crime. The reason is that during the reform period, which witnessed a massive effort to remake Russian society and the Russian economy, Russia once again fell victim to a false idea. The victory over communism was a moral victory. Millions took to the streets not because of shortages, but in protest over communism's attempt to falsify history and change human nature. As a new state began to be built, however, all attention shifted to the creation of capitalism, and in particular to the formation of a group of wealthy private owners whose control over the means of production, it was assumed, would lead automatically to a free market economy and a law-based democracy. This approach, dubious under the best of conditions, proved disastrous in the case of Russia, because in a country with a need for moral values, after more than seven decades of spiritual degradation under communism, the introduction of capitalism came to be seen as an end in itself. The young reformers were in a hurry to build capitalism, and they pressed ahead in a manner that paid little attention to anything except the transformation of economic structures. The calculation was sober, said Eliza Dolgova, an expert on organized crime in the office of the general prosecutor. Create through any means a stratum in Russia that could serve as the support of reform. All capital was laundered and put into circulation. No measures of any kind were enacted to prevent the legalization of criminal income. No one asked at privatization auctions, "Where did you get the money?" Enormous sums were invested in property, and there was no register of owners. A policy similar to this did not exist in a single civilized country. The decision to transform the economy of a huge country without the benefit of the rule of law led not to a free market democracy, but to a kleptocracy that had several dangerous economic and psychological features. In the first place, the new system was characterized by bribery. All resources were initially in the hands of the state, so businessmen competed to buy critical government officials. The winners were in a position to buy the cooperation of more officials, with the result that the practice of giving bribes grew up within the system. Besides bribery, the new system was marked by institutionalized violence. gangsters were treated as normal economic actors, a practice that tacitly legitimated their criminal activities. At the same time, they became the partners of businessmen who used them as guards, enforcers, and debt collectors. The new system was also characterized by pillage. Money obtained as a result of criminal activities was illegally exported to avoid the possibility of it being confiscated at some point in the future. This outflow deprived Russia of billions of dollars that were needed for its development. Perhaps more important than these economic features, however, was the new system's social psychology, which was characterized by mass moral indifference. If under communism universal morality was denied in favor of the supposed interests of the working class, under the new government, people lost the ability to distinguish between legal and criminal activity. Official corruption came to be regarded as normal, and it was considered a sign of virtue if the official, in addition to stealing, made an effort to fulfill his official responsibilities. Extortion also came to be regarded as normal, and vendors, through force of habit, began to regard paying protection money as part of the cost of doing business. Officials and businessmen took no responsibility for the consequences of their actions, even if those consequences included hunger and death. Government officials helped to organize pyramid schemes that victimized people who were already destitute. Police officials took bribes from leaders of organized crime to ignore extortion, and factory directors stole funds marked for the salaries of workers who had already gone months without pay. The young reformers were lionized in the West. But as the years passed and the promised rebirth of Russia did not materialize, debates broke out in Russia over whether progress was being prevented by the resistance of the Duma, by inadequate assistance from the West, or by the inadequacies of the Russian people themselves. These arguments, however, had a surrealistic quality because they implicitly assumed that with the right economic combination, it was possible to build a free market democracy without the rule of law. In fact, a market economy presupposes the rule of law, because only the rule of law can assure the basis of a free market's existence, which is equivalent exchange. Without law, prices are dictated not by the market, but by monopolization and the use of force. The need for a framework of law was especially acute in the case of Russia, because for ordinary Russians, socialism was not only an economic system, but also a secular religion that lent a powerful sense of meaning to millions of lives. When the Soviet Union fell, it was necessary to replace not only the socialist economic structures, but also the class values that gave that system its higher sanction. This could be done only by establishing the authority of transcendent universal values, which, as a practical matter, could be assured only by establishing the rule of law. On May 10, 1997, the Greek police found in a shallow grave under an olive tree, 2 miles from the Athenian suburb of Serenita, the dismembered body of Svetlana Kotova, one of Russia's top models and a former Miss Russia. It was learned that she had been the guest of Alexander Solonik, Sasha Makedonsky, Russia's number one professional killer, who had himself been found strangled 3 months earlier in the Athenian suburb of Baribobi. Svetlana's story evoked intense interest in Russia because of her youth and beauty, and because there was something about the romance between a 21-year-old beauty queen and a professional killer that was symbolic of the condition of modern Russia. Svetlana met Solonik in a Moscow nightclub on New Year's night 1997 and traveled to Greece on January 25 at his invitation. She was met at the plane with armloads of flowers and driven to Solonik's villa in a chauffeur-driven Mercedes. The rent on the villa was about $90,000 a year. Its amenities included a swimming pool, gym, basketball court, golf course, and gardens with sculptures. Beginning January 26, she called her mother every night. She said this was not life, but a miracle. The villa in Solonik's car contained a large quantity of firearms and other weapons, but it is not known whether Svetlana was aware of them. For 5 nights she lived as if in a dream, but on January 30, gangsters from the Kurgan Criminal Organization, a supplier of hired killers to the Russian underworld, arrived at the villa. While they were talking to Solonik, someone threw a thin cord around his neck and strangled him from behind. The visitors then came for Svetlana, who was on the second floor. When word of Svetlana's murder was released, the Russian newspapers were filled with pictures. Svetlana with flowing black hair in a long black gown with thin shoulder straps. Svetlana in a bathing suit looking out shyly from behind spread fingers. Svetlana with her head cupped in her hands. Svetlana in an evening dress with her hair in a bun off her forehead. No one, it seemed, could have been less prepared for the devilish game that she had fallen into. Yet the fate of Svetlana Katova had something in common with the fate of her nation, freely delivered into the hands of criminals during the period of reform. The rewards were quick and easy. There was a willful desire not to know. It remains to be seen whether, in the long run, Russia will share Svetlana's fate. But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will never come to me again. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 7. 1. The Kursk. Saturday, August 12, 2000. In the dim afternoon light of the Arctic summer, with pennants flying, and amid the deafening roar of exploding missiles and torpedoes, the nuclear submarine Kursk moved into position to take part in the largest naval exercises in the history of the Russian Northern Fleet. The area where the exercises were taking place, 130 miles northeast of Murmansk in the Barents Sea, was a region of immense strategic significance for Russia. The Northern Fleet, the most battle-ready section of Russia's armed forces, operated in the Barents Sea and was the key to Russia's ability to challenge the West and to Russia's status as a great power. The Kursk, one of eight active Oscar II-class submarines, was the pride of Russia's Northern Fleet. In the event of war, its task was to cut NATO in half by severing the transatlantic sea link. Its shipwreck missiles were capable of destroying an entire U.S. carrier group or transport convoy, or according to Russian naval sources, of being armed with nuclear warheads with a yield equivalent to that of 500,000 tons of TNT, sufficient to level Los Angeles or New York. The mission of the Kursk was to demonstrate its two principal capabilities, destroying both aircraft carriers and submarines. First, the Kursk fired its main weapon, the Chelomey Granite missile, codenamed Shipwreck, which contained a 1,600-pound conventional warhead. It scored a direct hit against a Russian Hulk target more than 200 miles away. The Kursk then prepared to fire the 100RU Vader torpedo, codenamed Stallion, at a simulated submarine. The Stallion, a top-secret weapon, was powered by a rocket booster that ignited underwater. Once the weapon was clear of the submarine, the booster sent it to the surface, and it homed in on its target like a missile. The Stallion to be fired by the Kursk was armed with a 220-pound warhead. As the Stallion was fired, however, something went disastrously wrong. The torpedo's rocket motor exploded inside the torpedo tube, melting its metal walls in seconds and filling the forward weapon bay with flames. The warhead then detonated, blowing a hole in the Kursk's reinforced hull. Icy water rushed into the ship but did not extinguish the fire, since the rocket booster was designed to burn without air. Flaming chunks of the booster were thrown into the forward weapons control room. The submarine was pulled sharply downward, and in a little more than 2 minutes, there was a second gigantic explosion of the Kursk's reserve torpedoes and torpedo-sized cruise missiles inside the torpedo compartment. The explosion ripped open the starboard side of the submarine back to the sail, an area the length of a school gymnasium. The force of the blast and a wall of seawater tore through the control room, destroying the switches, computers, and video screens that constituted the brain of the huge submarine. The living quarters forward of the reactor compartment were instantly flooded, leaving the sailors no chance to escape. At first, Russian naval officers assumed that the explosions, which measured 1.5 and 3.5 respectively on the Richter scale, came from the missile and torpedo that had been fired by the Kursk. But when attempts to establish radio contact with the submarine failed, an alarm was sounded and a massive search began. Finally, at 4:35 a.m. on Sunday, August 13, the Kursk was discovered on the sea bottom at a depth of 330 feet. At 7 o'clock a.m., President Vladimir Putin, who was vacationing in Sochi, was informed, and the Navy began organizing an effort to rescue the crew. Throughout Sunday, the Russian authorities said nothing about the missing submarine. On Monday, August 14, Russian officials released the first information about the disaster. They said that problems had occurred on the submarine on Sunday, and the Kursk had been forced to lie on the sea bottom. A short time later, they announced that communication had been established with the crew, that the Kursk was being supplied with electricity and fresh air, and that all of the crew were alive. All these statements, as events were to show, were untrue. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union had a rescue service that was considered to be as well-equipped as that of NATO. In 1991, Russian deep-sea divers performed a rescue at a depth of 985 feet, for which they received Star of the Hero of Russia awards. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, however, the rescue unit was disbanded. By 2000, the Russian Navy was without deep-sea divers, and its many submarines, long used mainly for intelligence gathering, lacked trained rescue personnel. In the case of the Kursk, Russian officials justified the decision to dispense with a functioning rescue service by arguing that the submarine was unsinkable. In the quiet provincial city of Kursk on Monday, October 14, people were caught up in the lazy rhythms of summer. There were few strollers on the street, and many of the factories were half empty. The city, the scene of the Battle of the Kursk Salient, which marked a turning point of the Second World War, is set in rolling hills and surrounded by fields of wheat, rye, and sunflowers. With the breakup of the Soviet Union, it lay only 60 miles from the independent country of Ukraine, but it remained a patriotic community that took pride in having given its name to Russia's most advanced nuclear submarine. Valentina Starosilteva, whose son Dmitry was a sailor on the Kursk, was sitting at her desk in the medical unit of a ball-bearing factory where she worked as a physiotherapist. Instead of seeing patients, however, she occupied herself packing a parcel for her son. It included cookies, candies, pens, disposable razors, paper, and notebooks, all of which were in short supply in Vidyevo, where Dima was based. At 3 o'clock p.m., a news broadcast came on the television. Valentina paid no attention to it. Suddenly, however, she realized that the announcer was describing an accident aboard the Kursk. Valentina put down what she was doing and began listening more closely. Dima had written to her that he was leaving for 3 days of maneuvers. She realized that a disaster had befallen the Kursk and that her son was on the ship. That evening, the fate of the Kursk dominated the Russian television news programs. With each hour, the information released by the Navy Press Service changed. Quite soon, the press service reported that radio contact had been lost, and that the only communication consisted of tapping coming from the ship's interior. The figures for the number of people on board also changed, from 107 to 130, to 116 or 117, and finally to 118. Such shifts led to speculation that officials were trying to conceal the presence of civilian specialists on board. As an armada of Russian ships gathered at the accident site in the Barents Sea, two rescue bells submerged repeatedly, but were unable to latch on to the Kursk. Navy officials reported severe storms in the region and said that the rescue work was being hampered by the sharp angle at which the submarine was lying, strong underwater currents, poor visibility, about 6 feet, and silt that was being lifted from the bottom. Britain, Norway, and the United States offered to assist in rescuing the trapped sailors. Both Britain and Norway had skilled deep-sea divers, and Britain offered to deploy its LR-5 mini-submarine, which is capable of resisting underwater currents and is equipped with a special joining hitch that allows it to attach to the hatch of a submarine, regardless of the list. The Russian government, however, refused the offers. A spokesman for the Defense Ministry said that Russia had everything that was necessary to rescue the men, that the presence of foreign ships would only cause confusion in the zone of operations, and that the technical parameters of the NATO rescue vessels might not coincide with those of the Russian submarine. Navy officials also began to suggest that the most likely cause of the accident was a collision with a foreign submarine. This possibility was rejected by the United States and Britain, the only powers with submarines in the area, but it was to be repeated continually by the Russian High Command, deflecting attention to a degree from questions about incompetence in the handling of torpedoes aboard the Kursk. Starosilteva sat at home with friends. She found it impossible to eat or to sleep. The official information made no sense. What did it mean for a submarine to lie on the bottom? Had it sunk, or was it just resting there? If the rescue effort was proceeding satisfactorily, why were the men still trapped? And why were the authorities refusing to accept foreign help? The telephone rang constantly. The mother and stepfather of Alexei Nekrasov, a friend of Dima's who served with him on the Kursk, called from the village where they lived, 27 miles outside Kursk. Alexei's stepfather, Vladimir Shalapin, a former submariner, told Valentina that on the basis of the existing information, there was reason to believe that their sons were alive. Staroseltseva also received a call from Valentina Budikina, chairman of the local committee of soldiers' mothers. She said that she was in touch with the Navy High Command, and that a trip to Vidieva was being organized for the relatives of the Kursk crew. By Tuesday afternoon, August 15, the number of ships at the accident scene had increased from 15 to 22. They included the Mikhail Rudnitsky, which brought two mini-submarines, the Pritz and the Bester. It was rapidly becoming clear, however, that the rescue effort was fundamentally flawed. The mini-submarines submerged repeatedly, but failed to attach to the submarine's hatch. Navy officials said that the rescue vessels were having trouble attaching because the docking ring around the hatch had been severely damaged, but that they continued to hear tapping coming from inside the submarine. At the same time, a diving bell took the first photographs of the Kursk. These showed that the entire nose section was gone, as if it had been cut off by a guillotine. It was now clear that if there were survivors among the crew of the Kursk, they were in the rear compartments of the submarine, which were farthest from the explosion. But even there, the sailors were threatened by the buildup of icy water and the rapidly diminishing supply of air. The full horror of the situation of the trapped sailors was described in the evaluations of military doctors that were published in the press. Valery Matlin, a military doctor in Vladivostok who had participated in many rescue operations, said, "The basic problems are cold, the absence of light, possibly of food, and surplus air pressure, as a result of which the extremities become numb. With such low temperatures, this is practically not noticed and attributed to the cold. If the system of cleaning the air does not work, there will be a surplus of carbon dioxide, and with this, there is a lowering of the motor functions and sleepiness and sweatiness, as a result of which the sailors are thrown from heat to cold. Besides, the metabolism slows, disturbing the function of the intestines. As a result, there is constipation and sharp pain in the stomach. But the most terrible is the reduction in the resistance of the organism and complete unawareness of actions. The lads absolutely do not understand their condition. They experience euphoria. They leave this life without understanding this." Oktay Abragamov, chief psychiatrist of the Pacific Fleet, said, "The situation is exacerbated by the low temperature at which the process of destruction of the psyche is accelerated. Of course, they are affected by the absence of light. People don't know how many hours in the day were passed in underwater captivity. Judging by everything, the sailors on the Kursk are completely disoriented. But nonetheless, I doubt that on board there is mass psychosis. There are probably very strong personalities." On Tuesday night, the Navy acknowledged for the first time the likelihood of fatalities. Vladimir Koroyedov, the commander-in-chief, said that in light of the catastrophic damage to the nose portion of the submarine, some sailors had undoubtedly died. He said that an effort would be made to save the survivors, but in sharp contrast to earlier optimistic statements, he admitted, "I'm afraid the hope for rescuing the sailors is not great." In answer to reporters' questions, he said that much depended on the situation inside the submarine, but that he would preserve hope until August 18. The news of the accident stunned ordinary Russians, who identified with the sailors trapped in an iron coffin at the bottom of the sea. Thousands went to churches to light candles and pray for the rescue of the men. Donations poured in from all over the country to a fund to aid the families of the crew. There were even donations from impoverished pensioners, some of whom could contribute no more than 5 rubles. At the office of the Committee of the Soldiers' Mothers in Kursk, relatives of the sailors gathered, with suitcases and bags of food, for the trip north. there were scenes of anguish and confusion. During the first few days of the crisis, many of the relatives had put their faith in the reassurances of the authorities, but as precious hours passed and the extent of the official misrepresentations became obvious, the level of fear steadily increased. In an atmosphere of growing desperation, family members became openly suspicious of the authorities. Many could not understand why Putin was continuing his vacation in Sochi instead of flying to Vidyevo. They also became suspicious of the continued refusal to accept foreign help. Some began to say openly that the real reason the authorities were refusing foreign assistance was that they were afraid of divulging military secrets, even if it cost the sailors their lives. At the accident scene, the rescue bells and many submarines were submerging continually, but could not attach to the Kursk. Navy officials, however, reported that there was contact with a submarine, and that the rescue operation was proceeding according to plan. As Valentina helped Budakina organize the trip in the office of the Committee of Soldiers' Mothers, she listened to the radio and television. From the almost continuous reports, it was clear that the whole world was riveted by the drama of the trapped sailors. In the United States, where news of the Kursk competed with the Democratic National Convention, a State Department spokesman said, "We are very concerned about the fate of the crew of the submarine and hope that the operation to rescue them will be a success." Throughout Western Europe, broadcasts on all television channels began and ended with reports about the Kursk. The Times of London wrote, "Horrible. This is the best word to describe the condition of the sailors now on board the submarine Kursk. Accident lights are burning in the darkness, the air is difficult to breathe, and there is deepening cold and soul-chilling fear. The sailors are sustained only by the hope that rescue is possible, and the conviction that they must, at all costs, hold on and wait for it." Finally, on the night of Wednesday, August 16, there were signs that the international reaction to the disaster was having an effect. The television news reported that after a call from President Clinton, Putin had ordered the Navy to accept help from any source. When she heard this, Valentina felt a wave of relief. She was convinced that her son's fate depended not on the Russians, but on the British and Norwegians. At 4:30 on the afternoon of Thursday, August 17, Valentina, her daughter Ina, and 14 other relatives of the crew of the Kursk boarded the Simferopol to Murmansk train in Kursk. The family members wanted to travel together, and an extra car without compartments was attached to the train. The relatives were seen off by a large group of reporters and friends. As the train moved north across the heart of Russia, however, the passengers retreated into themselves, barely speaking to each other. Night fell, and the lights of rural stations flashed by in the darkness. Valentina asked Shalapin what he thought the chances were that their children would be saved. He hesitated for a moment, and then said 50-50. At 12:30 a.m., the train pulled into Moscow, but no one went outside to buy mineral water or to smoke on the platform. The last car of the train was now completely dark. The next morning, the train stopped at Petrozavodsk, where a crowd of sympathizers were waiting at the platform. They brought food, including a bucket of steaming boiled potatoes, and shouted words of encouragement. From that point on, sympathizers met the train at every station, offering food, money, and words of support. But these gestures did little to change the mood of the passengers, who had withdrawn into themselves and seemed to be in a daze. A conductress later told reporters that in their presence her blood pressure went up and she had trouble with her heart. After a second night, the train left the forest zone and entered an area of bare hills dotted with dwarf pines north of the Arctic Circle. Nadezhda Shalapina showed Valentina an issue of Komsomolskaya Pravda with pictures of their sons that she picked up before getting on the train in Kursk. "Here is my son, and beside him is his friend Dima," she said. "I think our lads are not sitting on their hands. They are doing everything in order to save themselves. I believe my son will live." Valentina agreed, then closed her eyes and tried to rest. 2 hours later, the train arrived in Murmansk. In the meantime, two Norwegian ships, the Seaway Eagle with Norwegian divers aboard, and the Normand Pioneer, which was transporting the British LR-5 mini-submarine, were en route to the Barents Sea. The Norwegian divers were to prepare the Kursk for the arrival of the LR-5, which was then to lock onto the Russian submarine. When the relatives got off the train in Murmansk,
sample complete. Ready to continue?